Okay, a call to order the House Committee on Education for the 15th, for the Ides of March, for March 15th. First thing we're going to do is we're going to open the, not really a hearing, but kind of an informational piece. But as you know, we had an informational hearing on Measure 98 a couple of weeks ago, and we did that on February 8th. And as a request of the Speaker's office, we put together a work group to complete a report submitting any suggested statutory changes to Measure 98 and some of the things that came out in the hearing from the stakeholders. So this is an opportunity for the House Education Committee to receive an update from the work group. This is not a time for questions and answers on the ballot measure. And we have our co-chairs, which are Representative Barbara Smith Warner and Representative Carl Wilson, and they will provide an update on their work group. And we'll be doing this every Wednesday for about the next three Wednesdays. So if you would like to come on up. I'll open up the informational meeting on Ballot Measure 98 work group.
Well, good afternoon, committee. Carl Wilson, House District 3, State Representative. We're going to be giving you, as the chair mentioned, periodic reports on what's going on with this work group. We first met on March the 10th. Work group co-facilitators are the representative and myself. Stakeholders in the work group include Confederation of School Administrators, Oregon School Board Association, Oregon Education Association, Chief Education Office, Oregon Department of Education, Stanford Children, Reynolds School District, Northwest Regional Education Service District. There are 13 individual members. Of those members, Representative Smith Warner and myself, also Representative Susan McLean, part of that group, and Representative Johnson in that group as well. Representative Doherty began the process, stepped out, said goodbye, and we'll catch her later on. The work group has scheduled meetings for March 17, 24, and 31, and the work group plans to produce a report with recommended statutory changes to ballot measure 98. Final report is going to be issued to you, the House Education Committee, and the chair, and then given to the Speaker's office for approval. And final presentation will take place April 3rd to this House Education Committee.
Thank you, Representative Wilson, for the record. My name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I am a state representative from House District 45, Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I am honored to be serving on this little work group at the request of the chair, and I appreciate the opportunity. We spent the first meeting reviewing kind of the big four concerns that were brought up in the informational hearing that was held before this this committee in February. The first two, first was flexibility for districts. Given that ballot measure 98 allocates money depending on the number of students, there was some testimony about the idea of providing a funding floor for small school districts that were impacted by low student enrollment. And another significant concern was flexibility in program spending on the supplement, the confusing S's, supplement versus supplant, that ballot measure 98 requires grant monies to be spent on new programs, and this could duplicate efforts currently taking place. The concern was the opportunity to allow funds to be spent on existing programs as opposed to having them close and reopen programs.
I want to mention, just veer off course here for a moment, the first meeting went extremely well. We were very pleased with the makeup of that group, and I thought we covered a lot of groups, very amiable, and it was a good day. Second two concerns, if I can push that down the way here, flexibility in ADMW of student grade levels. As we took testimony there sometime back, the recommendation from testimony was to include elementary school and or middle school students grades 5 through 9 in the calculation of ballot measure 98 grant amounts. And then finally, flexibility for school district writing plans. Ballot measure 98 requires creation of plans and expenditure of funds in three areas, and they include CTE, that is career and technical education, college-level training opportunities and programs, and programs aimed at dropout prevention. The recommendation from testimony that we heard some time back was to include the allowance of one or two areas of focus as opposed to all three.
So those big four that came up in your committee hearing were where we started the conversation, kind of reviewed those. We went around the room and gave everyone an opportunity to both comment on those and also bring up any other concerns that they had. There were a few additional concerns that were indeed brought up in that group, including concern about the requirement of a program performance audit, that it was expensive, it could be expensive and challenging, and whether that should be kept in that form or in some other form. Clarification on whether participants may opt in or opt out of those Battlements 98 funds, whether schools are required to take them or they could indeed opt out. And a labeling issue of the requirement CTE, Computer Technical Education, has some legal definitions, certainly when it's tied to federal funds, about CTE as a series, it's a series of classes or programs that go over time and that lead to an outcome. And the idea of some classes that might seem CTE really were not, because they were just one-off classes. And so the ability to either count those as CTE, or do you call those dropout prevention, can you call that something else? The idea of, you know, how do we make it so that the districts can be as cueing to the intent of the measure without getting into any definitional trouble. So despite those couple of things coming up, we did agree, I believe, to stay focused on kind of the big four that came up in committee and deal with the other stuff potentially as it came up, but really the focus staying on those primary four. So the goal is, in those next three meetings, we're going to work through those big four, have some of the other stuff come up as we can, and then get to a point where we can come back and make a presentation to this committee.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you and Representative McLean and others taking time for this work group.
Thank you. Our
appreciate
pleasure.
It very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I close the informational hearing on the informational meeting on Ballot Measure 98 work group, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2867, Representative Evans. And Alethea, if you could read what the measure is.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2867 requires school districts ensure that individuals teaching in dual credit programs have completed a minimum of 27 quarter hours of graduate level coursework relevant to the course being taught. The requirements apply to teachers of courses for school districts, public charter schools, and students taught by parents or legal guardians.
Okay, thank you. Representative Evans.
Chair Doherty, members of the House Education Committee, thank you again for the opportunity to present a concept, a bill, an idea for consideration. For the record, I'm still Paul Evans, representing House District 20, perhaps not the prettiest, but one of the prettiest districts in the state of Oregon, representing the communities of Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, and parts of South Salem. This bill represents a somewhat straightforward policy, a belief that people who teach collegiate-level coursework should be academically prepared to do so. At most colleges and universities in the state of Oregon, post-secondary coursework must be taught by someone with at least 27 credits above a bachelor's or equivalent training. There are some, Chemeca Community College, for example, that actually requires a master's degree now to deliver college-level post-secondary coursework. Now, let me be clear. There are certain and specific programs within the K-12 system where collegiate level credit has long been awarded. AP programs, for example, are some of the best known. And to be clear, there are instances, the big three universities among them, where a person with a bachelor's delivers coursework under the guidance of a PhD or a master's degree senior instructor with a demonstrated expertise, and often in a manner that is similar to an apprenticeship, teaching people how to be teachers. And to be honest, the MAT program is an excellent program for preparing for the multiple different challenges that teachers face in the classrooms in our modern K-12 environment. My concern is the growing pressures upon the K-12 system to deliver courses on top of the actual K-12 curriculum that these districts are charged with providing in times where we cannot often sufficiently fund them to do the job that we've assigned them to do. I understand fully the need for school districts to be creative and find ways to compete in an age of open borders among public schools. That being said, we owe it to our students and parents and to our community to have a stronger, more comprehensive approach. I believe we should be working to fully fund the QAM. I believe we should also be ensuring that K-12 courses are taught in classrooms of adequate size and adequate support to fulfill the goals we have set as a community. Collegiate credit in high school is, in some cases, becoming a race to an unknown destination. I'm concerned that we risk the accreditation of the colleges and universities providing support, and we risk the financial health of the students believing they're receiving collegiate-level coursework and sometimes finding out that they did not. I realize there is a difference of perspective on this. I am very aware that there are people that will probably today tell you any number of reasons why this is a bad idea. Some will say I don't understand the existing delivery arrangements. Some will say training as a K-12 teacher is sufficient for delivery of collegiate-level content without the need for added study. And a few might suggest that I'm somehow opposed to students receiving college credit while in high school as a matter of philosophy. Look, I'm a college instructor. I have no dog in the fight for K-12 course delivery other than getting them the tools and support they need. I have about 15 years, hopefully, of good years teaching left, and hopefully I'll have a job for some time. So this is not about me trying to protect my job. But what I do have is experience. Over the past two decades, with a few interruptions associated with service in Afghanistan, Iraq, and a few other places, I've been teaching courses at the introductory level at college. I've taught at colleges and universities up and down the Willamette Valley. In simplest terms, I teach the young men and women who are products of our K-12 schools. I'm here to tell you, sadly, that many of those who received credit were not ready to receive credit. Some of these students will have to take the courses again and will have to pay for that themselves because financial aid does not pay for retaking college credit. If we continue to encourage pushing collegiate-level coursework into K-12 classrooms, we should be open-eyed about the responsibilities to the students and parents and clear and helpful in terms of providing the folks that are asked to do even more with the tools to succeed. I brought this forward before. I know that there are some programs that do it a fine job, but I am aware of circumstances where students have shown up with as many as 90 college credits, of which 90 college credits coming out of high school, many of them were not college level credit, at least not worthy of that. So my concern is, as we are having what I believe is a positive conversation about what we expect out of our K-12 system, and we're trying to find ways to be responsible and sustainable, that we don't inadvertently try to push too much onto the K-12 system, all for good intentions to make our students more competitive, but not to water down the value of collegiate credit. That's my pitch.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of Representative Evans? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we have about six people signed up, and so how about Keith Oosley, Gretchen Bruner, and Alan Kirby? You want to testify, and if you submit a testimony, if we can keep your comments brief, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Chair Doherty and Vice Chairs Hernandez and Wilson and members of the committee, I am Keith Usry. I'm the Deputy Superintendent at Willamette Education Service District here in Salem, and I'm pleased to provide comments to you on House Bill 2867 on behalf of 45 school districts in Marion, Polk, Yamhill, Washington, Tillamook, Clatsop, Columbia, and Lane counties who have participated in the Willamette Promise program during the last 3 years. First, I want to acknowledge the work of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for their leadership in developing a comprehensive set of standards for accelerated learning, work of particular benefit to rural, underrepresented, and first-generation students. The new standards provide three well-defined pathways of traditional dual credit, sponsored dual credit, or assessment-based dual credit. In 2015, when this bill, then numbered House Bill 3126, was introduced to this committee, I shared my view that measuring what students know and are able to do at the end of a course is far more important than measuring the number of graduate credits a teacher has earned prior to teaching the course. When college professors define course outcomes, align those outcomes with on-campus courses, create the assessments to measure learning, and collaborate with high school teachers, the experience for students is rigorous and consistent across the program. In Willamette Promise, course outcomes are generally aligned with national subject standards and can be crosswalked easily to the AP standards. All teachers are trained continuously by college and university faculty, and Promise teachers are required to use the prescribed outcomes and required to use the common assessments, and they norm their scoring practices in a collaborative environment that we call a professional learning community. Adding a new 27 credit hour requirement for these teachers will recreate an unnecessary barrier to students that all Promise projects were charged with dismantling. Those barriers create an access gap, and without access to accelerated credit programs, closing the equity gap is all but impossible. Data from the Willamette Promise shows that 30% of participants are Hispanic, compared to 13% of AP students and 18% of students in traditional dual credit programs. Also, 67% of Willamette Promise students are eligible for free and reduced lunch, a rate that's 10% higher than those that are served in traditional dual credit programs. Recently, the Oregon Department of Education and Higher Education Coordinating Commission sponsored a longitudinal study of Oregon's dual credit programs, and they looked at data from 2005 through 2013, and it showed a significant equity gap. For example, we know that fewer dual credit opportunities exist in rural communities, and we represent a number of rural communities. And students who receive free and reduced lunch, English language learners, migrants, and special education students all enroll in fewer dual credit courses. And the consequence is 92% of students who enrolled in dual credit graduate from high school, whereas roughly 68% of students not taking a dual credit course don't. So in your deliberations about House Bill 2867, I'm hopeful that you'll consider the impact on thousands of high school students who benefit from the Promise and other accelerated learning options around the state. And I thank you for your time, and I appreciate the work that you do for students in Oregon.
Okay, thank you very much. Next.
Chair Doherty, Vice Chairs Hernandez and Wilson, and members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Bruner, and I coordinate the Willamette Promise. Our program, again, works with 40 school districts across the state, and we partner with Western Oregon, Oregon Tech, and Corbin University. Today I'm here to tell you a story. I want you to meet Madison. Madison was a Hispanic student at a rural high school in Oregon, and she qualified for free and reduced lunch. She worked before and after school. She played varsity sports. She battled lupus. She didn't have any support from home, and she is a first-generation college student. Because her local high school is rural, it had been difficult in the past to recruit teachers who have master's level credits or a master's degree in a subject area. Many high school teachers have a bachelor's in a subject area and a master's in teaching. Madison had no access to dual and accelerated credit prior to the state's innovative plans with the Promise programs and standards for multiple models of accelerated credit, simply because of where she lived. Now meet Mrs. M. Mrs. M participated in the Willamette Promise. She meets the qualifications set forth by the sponsoring institution and participates in regular professional development. She has high expectations in her classroom, as recognized on her yearly evaluations and by the students in her class, and she has a proven track record of her students going on to college and persisting. Through the Willamette Promise, she has been able to use her experience and expertise, participate in college-led professional development, define common scoring and assessments to measure the student's success, and offer her students a rigorous course where they learn to be proficient writers at the 100 level. She is able to not only prepare them for the next step, but to help them have a step ahead. Her student Madison performed well in her writing course, as demonstrated by her formative and summative assessments aligned to the college learning standards.
Despite her many barriers, she is now enrolled in a local private institution's nursing program, where her promised credits have helped her to continue her success. She is still working two jobs, still battling health issues, and still has little parent support. Yet someone believed in her ability to earn college credit, gave her access to it in her school, and she persisted. These are stories that come from our outstanding Oregon teachers and students. There are many more that illustrate how the PLC process has helped to better align secondary and post-secondary outcomes, how professors have changed their pedagogy, and teachers have excelled in the content area. None of these stories would have been possible for underrepresented, underserved, and rural students without the innovation, energy, and funding of the state that the state has put forth thus far to find rigorous programs to serve all students. Please consider the impact of House Bill 2867 would have on students like Madison and teachers like Mrs. M. The future of Oregon has immense potential, and the programs across the state continue to build capacity for our schools and, more importantly, for our students. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, Vice Chairs Fernandez and Wilson, and members of the committee. My name is Alan Kirby, and I'm the principal of Staten High School. Go Eagles. Willamette Promise has been an integral part of our school's push towards college and career readiness over the last several years as I've become principal. Through the Promise, my students are able to access college-level courses that they would not have been able to do otherwise. Not only that, more and more students are able to know that they can, in fact, succeed at the college level, to think more about that as a possibility, and to earn credits that they really can use towards degrees. Last year alone, our students earned 261 credits for college with about a savings of $50,000. And I expect that we'll earn that much or more this year through a variety of courses. It's helped us to change the culture of our school to one where students don't just think about graduating, but to one where they think about what comes next. The program helps students focus not just on college overall, but also career. Our students are able to take classes towards career pathways that we've organized at our school, such as college chemistry, speech, and college-level math courses to help them prepare for what they want to do in the future. Changing the credits required in the academic area for teachers to teach these classes would make it very difficult, especially for smaller schools like ours that benefit to offer these courses to our students. Willamette Promise, as was said earlier, I think should be much more about what students know and can do than anything else. And they're able to prove that through consistent college and high school collaboration in these assessments. I hope that you'll remember rural schools and students and the access to this level of coursework that Willamette Promise gives when considering this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of this panel?
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Okay, the last three we have signed up is Julissa Rodriguez, Catherine Hallwell Templin, and Dan Michael. Michael.
She wanted to sign for the ethnic studies one.
And your name again?
Julissa.
Okay. Thank you for letting us know.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Doherty and Vice Chair Hernandez and Vice Chair Wilson and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Dan Melke. I am currently the Dean of the Colleges of Business and Education at Eastern Oregon University. And yes, I traveled the farthest. Since 2011, I have also been serving as the executive director of the original Promise Project, Eastern Promise. I'm here to address the issues that we believe are important in looking at these accelerated learning questions. As part of Eastern Promise, we have, for the entire time, had stringent requirements for the delivery of the courses that we provide for high school students by way of an extensive professional learning community system, whereby our college and university partners work closely with our high school teachers to ensure that they are teaching quality and college-level coursework. This can be viewed as a professional development activity for those teachers and is in many cases more important and more stringent than some of the things they might acquire if they were taking graduate level courses. We feel very confident that what we are doing and what the additional Promise sites have and continue to do is based upon the premise that we can, that we can in fact provide solid preparation for high school teachers to deliver quality and college level instruction. Thank you.
And I would like to note that yes, the Eastern Promise was the first promise.
Yeah.
So we will recognize that. Thank you.
Representative Doherty and Vice Chairs Hernandez and Wilson. My name is Catherine Hollowell-Templin, and I represent the High Desert ESD in Central Oregon regions. In the spring of 2014, the High Desert ESD and Central Oregon Community College and other regional partners leveraged an Eastern Promise replication grant to launch Cascades Commitment. Cascades Commitment is designed to increase the number of students who have access to accelerated college credits. Since that time, the program has qualified 63 high school teachers to teach Writing 121, 122, Math 111, Math 112, and History 201 across our region. The goal of Cascades Commitment is to create a clear path for any high school student in Central Oregon, no matter what high school they attend, to earn 20 core credits that meet foundational requirements for an associate's or bachelor's degree after high school. As we dove into this work, we realized that Cascades Commitment was about equity and access for our underrepresented students in the rural districts of Central Oregon. House Bill 2867 would undo virtually all of the work that has been accomplished by the Cascades Commitment. House Bill 2867 creates barriers to equity. 38 teachers who are currently qualified to teach through Cascades Commitment would likely lose their ability to teach dual credit. This means that the 10 high schools would lose approximately 20 dual credit courses, affecting hundreds of students within Central Oregon. Prior to Cascades Commitments, the schools in Central Oregon with the highest socioeconomic need and the highest diversity only offered dual credit courses through their career technical ed programs or no dual credit classes at all. Cascade Commitment works. In 2015 and 16 school year, the COCC Math 111 teachers designed four final exam questions, one corresponding with each course level outcome. All Math 111 instructors were asked to include these questions verbatim on their final exams in the fall of 2015. Both on campus at COCC and the dual credit classes in our high schools. Students who participated in a course taught by the Cascades Commitment qualified teachers answered three or four questions with greater accuracy, 92.5%, than the students taught by the College Now instructors, 63.8%, and the COCC instructors at 73.3%. This serves as a clear indicator of the quality of teaching and learning taking place in the Cascade Commitment classrooms. The support systems are in place. The systems to alternatively qualify our high school teachers in partnership with Central Oregon Community College are established and continuing. These pathways include intensive summer training and ongoing monthly participation in professional learning communities led by the college instructors. Going into our fourth year, we have teachers who continue to voluntarily attend these professional learning communities without any additional stipends or credit opportunities. Teachers report that Cascades Commitment is the best professional development that they've ever received in their entire profession. This community of teachers brings the region's best and brightest teachers together to expand their knowledge of the content area while sharing the best practices among the schools. We've established a relationship and a learning community with our higher education partners. As a result of our work, our local high school teachers have greater access to Central Oregon Community College and Oregon State University of Cascades. We have broken down barriers and developed a shared understanding of the mutual benefit of our ongoing work. Please do not allow House Bill 2867 to dismantle all of this incredible work that we've done. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Evans.
So, just a question. Between both of you, you see the requirement of having actual content area as bad, but training in how to teach a content area from a particular perspective as better?
I think the dilemma that we have is this.
Is if so, why have any content area whatsoever? Just have people teaching the test.
The dilemma for us is this. In trying to offer accelerated learning opportunities, the biggest barrier has been the fact that the teachers who are in the K-12 system, many of whom have years of experience and have a vast resource of qualifications that enable them to deliver the highest level. And many of these are already delivering advanced placement courses. The situation that we're faced in almost all of our promise sites is that due to the nature of many of our rural school settings, most of the teachers probably have a master's degree of some kind. You mentioned an MAT or something similar. But many of them do not have the opportunity in their career to have a master's in a particular discipline. That doesn't make them any less qualified to deliver some of that content. And the focus that we have made in our promise activities have been to, as was mentioned with the Cascade commitment, to provide the training opportunities through professional development that would be equivalent to the kinds of things they would learn if they were in a graduate level class. So in answer to your question, it's not about teaching them teaching skills. It's about improving their understanding of the content, and more particularly getting on the same page with the college instructor in terms of the outcome expectations by way of assessments that the students are expected to achieve.
I'm trying to appreciate your position. I still don't understand how more content, more actual rigorous study in college level content is worse and an obstacle in true forms. I understand the financial situations. I understand rural schools. I get it. But if you're telling me right now that it's better, more successful, to have somebody teaching people how to teach college-level credit rather than actually learning it on their own and then teaching it, I don't understand what our entire education system in terms of credentialing is about then.
I guess I don't think it's a matter of good or bad. I think it's of course gaining more content would be beneficial.
You said this was an obstacle and dangerous, I think is what you said.
I think that by requiring this,
mastery of content that they're going to be teaching.
The question, please.
By requiring the 27 hours, it would create barriers, particularly for our rural districts where teachers don't have access or opportunity to be in universities and take that level of ongoing content work. And what we're doing, for example, with Cascade's commitment is these teachers are meeting regularly, monthly, with the instructor at COCC and also working with OSU instructors to gain the content that they need. And so they're doing both. They're learning, they're building their pedagogical skills, and they're increasing their content area skills. Okay. And so it's not a matter of either or.
If this were enacted, it would halt the opportunity at many of the schools almost immediately because the teachers would not have, many of those teachers would not have that 27 credits or whatever credits might be required. Is it a good idea to get more content? Absolutely. We are not opposed to that. We just think that we are providing those content opportunities through the programs we were already doing without requiring those teachers to spend additional personal resources to get graduate level, plus the fact that many of those content courses would not be available to them wherever they're living. They might, you know, rarely are those going to be available on a on an online basis. And so it does present a serious obstacle to those teachers, and hence presents an obstacle to the accelerated learning opportunities of the students.
And I just would like to add, if I may, 4 years ago, before we started this, there was a meeting that Danny attended with us, and our college deans from COCC were there, and they basically said, your high school teachers are not able to do this because they don't have the content area. And as we walked through our first year of the pilot and moved on, and continued our conversations with COCC, they are now our biggest advocates, and they have gone throughout the state and a number of other conferences throughout the nation to say, this is what our program is and this works, and they are our biggest advocates. They now see that these 68 teachers that I mentioned in Central Oregon can and do teach the content well.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for coming all this way. Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2867 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2845. And so if you could introduce the bill, and then we do have a lot of people here, but we do have at least chosen panels that we'll be calling on for this bill.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2845 requires the Oregon Department of Education to convene an advisory committee consisting of 14 members to develop statewide ethnic studies standards for adoption into existing statewide social studies standards for grades K through 12, requires the advisory committee to provide a list of suggested materials, resources, samples, and curricula, skills training programs for grades K through 12, and it establishes the advisory committee membership and law.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Representative Fernandez, Representative Gallegos, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Diego Hernandez. I am the state representative for House District 47, Great East Portland. So I'm here to talk to you about HB 2845. I wanted to bring several things to your attention before I begin talking about the bill. In front of you, you'll see all the endorsing organizations and associations that have signed on to support the bill. And if you look on OLIS and you look up this bill, you'll see all the chief sponsors, including some of you all, and co-sponsors. So this bill does three things. One, it convenes a group of 14 folks that would advise the Department of Education to create they will recommend ethnic studies standards K through 12 to be embedded into social studies standards. This group is made up of a very diverse set of folks that includes teachers, one professors, ODE professionals, and different stakeholders from the community. It also directs the department to adopt these ethnic study standards into existing statewide social study standards. And something that I want to point out that you should all know, last time social study standards were updated was 2011, and they are currently in the process of being updated. Just pointing that out, because this fits right in line with their current process. It also requires the department to track it through the Division 22 standards. So what does even ethnic studies mean? Right, you may be thinking, maybe not, I hope not. It just has to do about ethnicity. Actually, it's a little bit more than that. It includes different communities of color, but it also includes social minorities, which includes women, people with disabilities, immigrant refugees, and individuals from the LGBTQ community. On top of the ethnic minorities are labeled as Native American or Americans of African, Asian, Pacific Island, Chicano, Latino, or Middle Eastern descent. And just a heads up quickly, We're probably going to define Middle Eastern, so we'll be providing an amendment to that to give it a more clear definition. So what are folks saying in support of this? And I think it's really critical and important for me to point out that there has been many studies that have recently come out from different states that have already implemented this, and different studies of programs that exist in different public education systems that have found that by reflecting the histories and contributions of all people in curriculum, this helps increase student engagement, attendance, and GPA, and ultimately graduation rates. Also, by reflecting the histories of all people, Ethnic Studies supports an Oregon holistic approach to addressing chronic absenteeism and fostering civic engagement. By gaining knowledge and understanding of different cultures and histories, Oregon students are better equipped to participate in a global economy and engage with diverse communities. For me, this is important as a former educator, as somebody who grew up in Oregon's public education systems, didn't see themselves reflected in the teachings of social studies until I went to college and learned about how much of our communities are actually at the very fabric and root of this country, and how much contribution our communities have provided this nation, and that is one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about this, because when I used to teach, my students were not engaged, right? They weren't, the things that we were teaching them, they didn't see themselves in it. And yet I knew in the back of my head that their ancestors had so much to do with the fabric of our country. With that, I'm going to leave it for the rest of the panelists who are going to provide testimony for you all today, which includes teachers, students, a superintendent, a professor, and other stakeholders, and including my great colleagues next to me. Thank you. And if at all possible, I would appreciate if we, you know, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm never going to do that. I would appreciate we hold questions to the end. That way, some of these folks may answer some questions you have.
Are you saying you do not want us to ask you a question?
You can. I'm just saying you may want to wait till the end. Somebody may answer your question in their testimony.
Thank you very much.
I like it.
Okay. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you very much, Chair. Before I get started, I just want to say on behalf of the citizens of this great state, how refreshing it is to see such an attractive panel up there. Thank you very much. Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Hernandez, and Wilson, Representatives Evans, McLean, Parrish, Solomon, and Springer, and Vial.
Vial,
sorry.
Vial's good. Thank you.
Vial. Sounds, yeah. All right. So for the record, my name is Joseph Gallegos, and I am a new member of the a longtime supporter of the Oregon Commission on Hispanic Affairs. I'm here today for the chairs of the four advocacy commissions, representing our support for House Bill 2845 and the importance of ethnic studies in Oregon success. I just want to say, in my day job, I'm the owner of Western Research Associates, a social research and development consulting firm. I'm also a professor emeritus at the University of Portland, Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences. My academic career in higher education spans 40 years, can you believe it, with much of it devoted to diversity training and research. Indeed, I am credited with, in the literature anyway, as one of the scholars who initiated the concept of cultural competence. It is with this background that I speak in support of the bill before you. The Oregon Commission on Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs, Black Affairs, Hispanic Affairs, and Commission on Women support this bill. That will establish an ethnic studies advisory group convened by the Oregon's Department of Education. We believe that including ethnic studies in the social studies standards is a missing piece that not only provides more inclusive and relevant curriculum engaging all students, but will also do its part in improving dropout rates and other measures important to the successful education for every community. And I'm going to go off script a bit here, which is what I want to do anyway. I just want to make two points. One that has to do with bilingual education, which is, this is not what this is about. But if we look at bilingual education, I mean, the research is strong that teaching kids, young people, in two languages really enhances their probability of success in school, right? This is very similar. If we can increase the motivation, the self-esteem of these young people by being inclusive, including their heritage in our education process, that, I would argue, will then increase the probability of their success in education. The other point I want to make is about cultural competency. Sort of the first, one of the first principles of cultural competency is that we're aware and appreciate diversity. Simply that. You know, being aware that there is a difference. But that's only the first step. If we don't take it the next step, it's useless. I mean, it's nice, but it's useless. So the next step is really, once you're aware, once you're sensitive to cultural differences and so on, what do you do with it? How do you implement that knowledge effectively? And that's what this study group will do. It will help the legislature, will help the state of Oregon to take that next exciting step as to how can we then incorporate this into an effective process that will get us all to 40-40-20 and really affect the interests of everybody in the state. So that's why I'm excited about the bill, and that's why the commission is really behind it. Thank you. And I take questions, but...
Senator Frederick.
Thank you very much, Representative Chair Daugherty, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I want to go at this in a perhaps a different way. I think that one of the main things...
If you could identify yourself, please.
I am Senator Lou Frederick from District 22, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you. I think this allows us to tap into a level of curiosity that every student has, every kid has, about what's going on around them. In my view, children are cultural anthropologists. They're trying to figure out where they fit into our society. And they don't know. And one of the mistakes that we've made over the years is to narrow what their society actually might be. This expands that. It allows folks to understand what the contributions are for all sorts of people, all sorts of folks who are here in Oregon, all sorts of people who are around the globe. Now, I was lucky. I grew up in an academic environment, a black colleges environment, where I got a chance to know about all sorts of people, and the history of the African-American community did not start with slavery. You got a chance to find out about the libraries of Mali and to understand what Timbuktu was about. Timbuktu was not just a phrase that people might use. In fact, it was an incredible library, an incredible civilization that was there that well before most of the folks understood what was most of the things that you hear about. Why didn't we hear about that? Why didn't folks hear about that? Well, that's because in certain places it was not even mentioned. It was not. If you look it up now, you will find it. One of my favorite new television shows is Africa's Great Civilizations by Henry Louis Gates, which many people don't even know. They watch that show and they go, I didn't know that. But we have the contributions to science, music, literature, math, all of these things and that are not just history. They are, in fact, things that are taking place right now. And they came from places and from people that look like the kids in our classrooms, but the kids in our classrooms don't know about them. It is time that they knew about them. And this is the kind of ethnic studies approach that I think we need to be taking. Let's show people what actually takes place in the world around them. What was there? Who was there? What were they doing? That's what the ethnic studies program should be. It should be tapping into the curiosity of our students and our families and our people. That's what I'm so excited about. I'm absolutely excited about this, to see this. We've seen attempts like this in the past. The Portland Public Schools put together what they called their baseline essays back in the early 80s, early 90s. They started in the early 80s. It was a flawed situation, but they tried their best. They did some great work, but they attempted to try to show where certain groups, where the contributions came for certain groups. This builds on that, and I think it expands it in a way that we could all be very proud to say, Oregon students understand what the world is about. Not a small part of the world, not just a certain set of cultures, but what the world is about. And they can talk with people in the world about what's going on. I'm extremely excited about this. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. So Representative Hernandez, I'm assume that you will be able to answer all the questions if they were not answered by the panelist.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to wait for questions. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, the next panel we have is Alejandra Berrigan, Alexis Kennard, and Karen Gray. Welcome.
Chair Doherty and members of the House Education Committee, hello. My name is Alexis Kennard, and I'm a senior at Roosevelt High School in North Portland. I have a passion for the arts, community, and advocating for the changes that I wish to see in the world. I've grown up in the St. John's neighborhood and have been a student in Portland Public Schools for the last 13 years of my life. I soon will be attending a university outside of Oregon, and I keep reflecting on my education, and in this sense, Oregon's education system has shaped me in many ways. As a young Chinook native and Pacific Islander woman who had little exposure to my own culture, it is easy to say that I have felt a lack of representation of my background within school environments and its curriculum. I feel my history is written in missing pages of our textbooks, and this is why ethnic studies is so important to me. We need to start thinking critically and to question everything. Ethnic studies will start conversations. It will spark the drive to seek change. And we're here because we're demanding change. We're demanding to be taught our own histories. Discussions will bring people together, build relationships, and the capacity to organize for change and growth in our young communities. We need to build a collective force. We need to fight together for systemic change. And we're here for ethnic studies because we all know it's important for us young people to know our history. To know that the first woman to run for president was not Hillary Clinton, and that the first black president to run for president was not Barack Obama, it was Shirley Chisholm. And that she was the first black woman to run for president, a story that I have never seen in my curriculum. Ethnic studies is essential to break down barriers and stereotypes written by the people for the people. Not just ethnic minorities, but those that are differently abled, LGBTQI, women, refugees, and immigrants. Those belonging to historically and currently marginalized communities. Ethnic studies will do this and much more. Relationships will be built, students will be challenged and engaged. Young people will be more prepared to face the world, equipped with the knowledge of history and of self. The pathway for success begins with knowing the resiliency, the passion, and contributions of our communities. So let's teach the whole history, not just bits and pieces. It all starts by reading the missing pages in our history books. And I urge you to support House Bill 2845. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry, we don't have clapping during our hearings. You can go like this, though. Thank you.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, my name is Alejandra Barragan, and I'm a second grade Spanish immersion teacher at Alder Elementary in the Reynolds School District. I am a member of the Oregon Education Association and proud to speak on behalf of OEA in favor of House Bill 2845. OEA represents over 44,000 members across the state of Oregon. Our members are educators working in the pre-K through grade 12 public schools and community colleges. OEA has been a part of conversations around this legislation with student leaders and the over 50 endorsing organizations that have signed on to support ethnic studies standards since late last summer. Though educators have been engaged in research on the benefits of ethnic studies for decades, this legislation has had a significant amount of work put into it, and we appreciate that OEA could give extensive feedback on it. We want to thank Representative Hernandez and his staff,
the Oregon Student Association, Momentum Alliance, and the Asian American Pacific American Network of Oregon for their leadership in this bill. Our first reason for supporting House Bill 2845 is the benefit that it has for students by cultivating critical thinking. In 2011, the National Education Association published a research report titled The Academic and Social Value of Ethnic Studies. The report concludes that well-planned ethnic studies curricula are often very academically rigorous. Rather than being divisive, ethnic studies helps students bridge differences that already exist in experiences and perspectives. In these ways, ethnic studies plays an important role in building a truly inclusive multicultural democracy and system of education. The NEA report notes that beginning as early as elementary school, students have been found to respond to curriculum based partly on what they learn and experiences in their homes and communities. This is another reason we support this legislation. Students can learn about their own representation throughout history and connect with it and engage with it. In my own classroom this year, in our immersion program, we have purposely selected texts and experiences that reflect students in the classroom. Our second grade students had the opportunity to learn roles of judges, school board members, police officers, and firefighters in our community, and the purpose of bills and policies. We introduced texts on Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, Sonia Sotomayor, and invited our school board member, Diego Hernandez, to come to speak with our students, to learn about real experiences, see real people who look like them, creating change in their own communities. This is not a novelty happening in our classrooms here in Oregon, but what House Bill 2845 does is not having to have arguments prepared for administrators on why we need inclusive texts in our classrooms and our curriculum. Several studies summarized in the NEA report on ethics studies note that positive impact ethics studies can have on student engagement, academic achievement, graduation rates, and student engagement. Ethics studies can help students form respect for each other and challenge each other as they learn about their shared experiences, commonalities, and their differences when we teach about the experiences of everyone, including ethnic and social minorities, as House Bill 2845 lays out. By gaining knowledge and understanding of different cultures and histories, Oregon students are better equipped to be active citizens and engage with diverse communities. The Oregon Education Association urges you to join us in supporting House Bill 2845 for the positive impact it can have on student achievement and engagement. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Superintendent Gregg.
Thank you so much, Chair Daugherty and members of the committee. It's my privilege to be here today to speak to you. I'm Dr. Karen Fisher Gray, and I have been the superintendent of the Park Rose School District since 2007. Before that, I was the superintendent of the Coos Bay School District. I currently chair the Chief Education Office's Oregon Ed Equity Advisory Committee that is tasked to develop and distribute the former Minority Teacher Report, now called the Education Equity Report. Our committee works to find ways to develop policies and practices that recruit, hire, retain, and promote racially and linguistically diverse people into the education workforce in Oregon. This is from educators, from educational support staff, to teachers, to principals, to superintendents. And I'm proud to say that Senator Lou Frederick is a member of this august team. It is my honor to be here today to speak to you on behalf of House Bill 2845, the Ethnic Studies Bill. In fact, I'm just downright excited. First off, what an amazing group of social justice advocates have been brought together to create this wonderful piece of legislation. I have mad respect for all of them and what they endeavor to achieve. The idea of the bill is to set forth requirements for graduation that include the teaching and learning of social studies standards that specifically cover curriculum about race, culture, ethnicity, genders, sexual orientations and expressions held by the richly diverse people of our nation. Currently, there are limited requirements and standards in social studies that touch somewhat lightly, in my opinion, on some of these cultural differences. School districts must ensure that certain learning objectives listed in the standards are covered in specific classes at different grade levels. However, a district may choose just how deeply and varied the curriculum will be in order to satisfy the requirements of the state. There is little taught regarding sexual expression and orientation, and even less about Chinese American and Native American cultures. This bill would require that a work group be created in order to create and develop the elements of an ethnic studies course for high school students that would be deeper in breadth and scope than what is currently required. Professional development opportunities for teaching staff will be developed so that we're not asking teachers to instruct students in a curriculum that they are unfamiliar with. I hope that later students in high school will be required to take and pass a course called Ethnic Studies as part of the social studies standards for graduation. This bill and its implementation will ensure that all Oregon students will be exposed to and learn deeply about important history that is up-to-date knowledge about the rich diversity in our community, in our state, and in our nation. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak with you about the Ethnic Studies Bill, House Bill 2845, along with Senate Bill 182 regarding the Council on Education Advancement and Ed Equity Bill, Senate Bill 13 regarding tribal curriculum, Senate Bill 280 about teaching Oregon history through the eyes of all Oregonians, especially those who have been marginalized and forgotten. This piece of legislation will bring social justice and equity to Oregon's educational system, something we talk about, but now needs to be demonstrated. This bill is good for all students, just as it's good for all students to have teachers of color. This bill is beneficial for all students. This bill is also supported by the Confederation of School Administrators. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, the next three we have is Amadeus, Patricia Sarkorai, and Max Jensen. And then we have three others signed up after you, and we just want to make sure that the three that were not scheduled, we're going to let you testify, but if it can be very brief, we would appreciate it. Okay. But not you, you're on the list.
I'll start. Hello, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aminata Diaz-Chacon, and I'm a member of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition Board. With OSA. After spring term, I will be the first in my family as a second-generation immigrant to receive a bachelor's degree from Western Oregon University. I would like to start off by sharing a bit about my high school experience and connection to ethnic studies. I went to Canby High School for my first 2 years and then Silverton High School for my last 2 years. There was no ethnic studies classes in the curriculum, despite Canby having a large Latino population. However, the only history that is taught is a Eurocentric version of U.S. history. What's not taught and understood is that the history of people of color in marginalized communities play a huge role in the history of this country and have had major contributions. My first ethnic studies class was a course called Chicano Latino Studies at Chemeketa Community College with Dr. Leo, who was a passionate professor that really motivated students from my class, and because of that, many of us are still pursuing a higher education. He showed us the significance of the struggles of our ancestors and the resiliency of our parents when they came across the border, teaching us to embrace our roots and fulfill the dreams that they themselves could not achieve. In this class, we went to North Salem High School and spoke with teachers there and asked them why they think students from marginalized communities tend to drop out at higher rates than their white counterparts. They said that the lack of connection and shared experiences with their teachers is what discouraged them from continuing. Ethnic studies creates a rigorous and relevant learning environment benefiting all students through increased engagement in their education. This is extremely crucial for students in K-12 who are still forming their identities and will empower them to continue their education beyond high school and become more than their respective stereotypes. I truly wish when I was going through K-12 the opportunity to learn about my cultural heroes, because now I understand more than ever the importance of being represented in history. Ethnic studies will increase interest, ownership, and responsibility for young people who can see themselves represented in the classroom, supporting better academic outcomes for Oregon students of color and students with marginalized identities. Ethnic studies creates pathways to success for students by building their knowledge of different racial and cultural groups and creating opportunities for more advanced learning. I urge you to support House Bill 2845 to ensure a successful educational future for all young Oregonians. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Congratulations on your
diploma. Hi. Chair Doherty, members of the committee. I'm Max Jensen. I work with the Oregon Student Association and the LGBTQA3 at the University of Oregon, where I'm a student. I wrote the issue brief that prompted OSA to try and get this bill started. Why it's really important to me, anyways, I'm focusing more on the LGBT aspects of it, but also all of it. I grew up a queer brown kid in a medium-sized town that was very isolated, and I knew very early on that I was gay, before I knew what the word was for gay. But through elementary school and most of my younger years, I felt really isolated, very alone. I learned to really hate the other students at my school because I saw very happy futures for all of them that I didn't think was an option for me because I didn't see any, you know, representation of myself anywhere. I had to work really hard to find a precedent for people like me living full lives and living meaningful lives because I didn't see them in our textbooks. We didn't talk about them in my classes. I couldn't ask my parents about them, and I couldn't ask my peers about them. My grades starting very early on in sort of the middle of elementary school, around when I was 7, they were horrible. They averaged around D's through middle school, especially. And the other students in my school were particularly vicious. They called me names. They threw food and rocks at me in the breaks, and they harassed me physically, verbally, and sexually as well. This sort of culminated when I was 14. I was chased out of my hometown with rocks by a group of boys, which I thought was relatively normal. But a friend of mine sat me down and told me that we should leave. So we started school in another district, drove 45 minutes to an hour every day to get to class in the morning over very windy roads, and I got sick every morning and threw up too often just trying to get to school. But the school was wonderful. They had an inclusive curriculum that also included queer people. I grew up in California. They did have inclusive curriculum on many lines, but hadn't yet included LGBT people in that telling of history. We were encouraged to learn about communities of color and queer communities. I was told to give a presentation on the experiences of LGBT people, and I wasn't ready for that at the time, but it felt good to know that I was validated by my teachers. But my grades at this school, they shot up. I was getting A's in all of my classes. I learned 2 years of math in one. And my teachers and my peers were very friendly to me. My teachers loved me. I tutored the other students. That school sadly shut down after a year. It was a charter school. We didn't have enough students enrolled at the time. It was just starting out. So I had to return back to my hometown and that school where I was officially outed over the summer by a friend of mine. Students were again cruel, but I was much more confident than I was before I had gone to the previous school. I knew a better environment, and I knew how to be happier where I was. But I still avoided walking up the hill to class every day because the other students would talk about me loudly walking by, or they'd literally point at me and talk. They'd make up rumors about anyone I talked to, so I lost a lot of my friends. I skipped my classes because students would ask me lewd questions in the middle of lectures, and I didn't feel safe there. My teachers, though, some of them were wonderful, saw that I was struggling and prompted me to leave. They told me to test out and go to college as soon as possible. So it was before my senior year of high school. I left and went to a community college and worked my way up into the University of Oregon. If I had learned what people like me were called from a teacher instead of from cruel students, I think I probably would have felt I had a future, more of a future for the majority of my youth than I did. and education, I think, would have felt like a more valuable investment for my life, so that I could do more things later on. Ethnic studies and inclusive curriculum, like, it's really, really important for everyone. It shows students that their schools are also for them and not just for a specific sect of society. And it prompts us to do much better in our classes to succeed more.
I hate to have you wrap it up.
Sure.
We've got three, four more people in about 5 minutes.
Okay.
So thank you. I'm sorry, but thank you so much for your story. It's very important.
Thank you.
Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Hernandez, Vice Chair Wilson, and other members of the committee, my thanks for allowing me this opportunity to support and to explain support of HB 2845. I joined over 20 organizations in voicing my support for ethnic studies. I also want to express my gratitude for everyone who's offered testimony today. I think as someone who's devoted a career to ethnic studies, it's beyond words. My name is Patricia Sakurai. I'm a professor at Oregon State. I have been teaching ethnic studies for the past over 20 years now, and I can definitely express my own testimony to the positive impact of ethnic studies on our students. First of all, and again, a lot of this echoes what's already been said, for students who are coming from underrepresented, marginalized communities, the meaning of what it means to encounter course material that reflects their own experiences, their lives, their families, and communities. You know, again, it's an incredibly powerful experience.
And we have your written testimony here in front of us if you'd like to just summarize
how important the program is. That's okay. I'm going to go off script since you have that. And I feel, given what has all been said, trying to figure out what 2 cents I can add. So I think, you know, definitely seeing that play a key role in offering a sense of inclusion in academia. A number of our students have gone on to graduate school and careers in academia, and I think thinking through a sense of ownership in what is going on in the classroom and inclusion is incredibly meaningful. Recent research has certainly confirmed that in lower grades, and kind of thinking through the Stanford study, I think stands out in my view. Boring with some numbers here, but I think it's definitely striking to a lot of us. That study looked at a 4-year time period tracking students who entered high school with a 2.0 GPA or lower, 1,400 participants. And for those who took ethnic studies, they saw a 21% increase in attendance over those 4 years, an increase of about 1.4 points in their GPA, and an additional 23 credits earned towards graduation as compared to those students who did not take ethnic studies. Right. Secondly, I think in terms of the impact of ethnic studies, it's just basic education for all of our students. I have had students over the years, especially in our 101 and 201, who have expressed frustration and sometimes outright anger that they had not encountered this curriculum before this, right, that they went through their K-12 and only basically got part of the story, right, and in their view. And I think just the fundamental ways in which ethnic studies rounds out their education and gives them a much broader and fuller view and appreciation of the diverse world and society in which they live. And finally, echoing others, critical thinking. As an educator, it has been absolutely instrumental in my ability to help students hone their critical thinking skills. They are having to grapple with multiple perspectives. They actually have to think outside their own box and realize there are other subjectivities beyond my own, right? And I think that really helps in kind of thinking through these complicated social dynamics and broader systemic structural issues that we grapple with, right? And I think, you know, certainly it's timely about thinking about how this translates, even though I teach at university level, how this translates to other grades and age-appropriate curriculum. I'm actually serving as a chair of an honors thesis of a student who is working on a board game geared towards middle school students. Like, how do I make this accessible to them? I have another student who's writing a Nepali-American children's book. So that said, I cannot officially speak for Oregon State, as I've been told to make sure to say, but certainly as an educator, I absolutely support HB 2845. I think it offers an enrichment of Oregon curriculum and also a means of having a more equitable outcome in learning for our K-12 students.
Thank you very much. Now, we have three other people that were not on the panel but signed up, and I can have you come up and speak, but I'm going to have you speak only for 1 minute, if that's okay. And that was Julicia Rodriguez, Paul Crystal, and I can't read your Francis Loberg. But as I say, I'm serious, at like 1 minute.
So can I start?
If you
want to
already start. Yeah.
Okay. I'm Julis Rodriguez. I teach first grade at a local school here. I just think this ethnic study is very important. My personal history is that I've been fighting for this since I was a high schooler. That was many moons ago. But and I saw that even when I was going to college, there was just classes available for it and not actual degrees. So I went out of state and got a bachelor's degree in Chicano studies, came back a few years ago, came back home to teach back in my community, and was told that that degree wasn't considered a history degree, so I was unable to teach at the middle school level, even though I went and got the content, which we were talking about, which is very important. Also, just the depth of the difference between the Anglo experience between the other ones. Our students know the dental history of George Washington, but don't know how the Filipino community contributed to movements that the Cesar Chavez did. So,
thank you. Thank you so very much. Okay, next.
Oh, Chair Doherty.
I'm going to put my teacher hat on, and I will cut you off.
Okay. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify. My name is Paul Crystal. I live here in Salem, and I speak in support of House Bill 2845, and Francis and I are going to testify together, so I think we can keep it short.
I'm Fran Loberg. I live in this town in the Inglewood neighborhood. Oh, that's right. Paul and I serve as co-chairs of the Racial Justice Organizing Committee. We are a Salem-based group of allies supporting the work of organizations representing peoples of color in our city. Our organizing principles include action in support of those organizations and taking responsibility for our own learning. We conduct ongoing study sessions on issues of racism, structural inequality, oppression theory, privilege, and similar topics to deepen our understanding of racism and its impact on our community.
And in our effort to learn, we're confronted by a deep lack of awareness of racial and cultural differences that exist in our society. There's a profound lack of understanding of the experiences faced by subordinated ethnic, racial, and social groups among us. A major result of our lack of understanding of each other and of the structural and institutional barriers placed in the path of subordinated groups is fear and hatred. The less we know about each other's experience, the more prone we are to appeals to fear and hatred of the other. The less we understand about the systemic inequality that exists in our institutions and social structures, the more we are likely to reject any personal responsibility or social responsibility to create justice for all.
Our children must be given the opportunity to learn about the full diversity of our community and of our society. We must give them the chance to overcome fear and hatred through understanding, both at individual and systemic levels. We must learn about each other and the richness of our varied experiences in this society. Every ethnic, racial, and social group possesses a full panoply of historical and current experiences within the society, some magnificent and wonderful, and some horrific, painful, and life-threatening. It behooves us all to learn more about each other and the depth of our lived experience in this society.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I'm going to have to cut you off, but we have one more hearing to go through. So,
okay.
Anyway, and so I'm actually also not going to open it up to questions because I think it's going to be more comments. If we have questions, we will get back on the record on Monday. Or
you can email me.
And, well, it's going to be on the record. So we will answer questions on the record for Representative Hernandez. Okay.
Wednesday? Are we doing a public hearing on the bill?
No, we're just, okay. Just if you have any questions of...
I do have one technical question about the bill.
Okay. Can we ask it Monday? We'll gavel out, ask it Monday on the record with Representative Hernandez.
So
we've got one more panel.
You'll ask it Monday. So you're putting this back on as a public hearing on Monday?
Yes.
With no work session because there's not an amendment yet.
Not right now.
Okay.
So with that, I'm going to close. What am I going to do? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2845. And open a public hearing on 3015. Thank you very much. If you can go leave quietly.
Clarify.
Thank you. Thanks for all your help. And where's...
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 3015 allows school districts and public charter schools to allow nationally recognized high school assessments in mathematics, science, or English. If the assessment complies with the State Board of Education by rule, it requires districts or public charter schools to send the appropriate notices to parents regarding the assessment.
Okay, where are we?
Emily.
Okay.
You tell her her umbrella. Her umbrella. Right there, that gal.
All right, welcome to the committee. And once again, we're hearing House Bill 3015. And before us, Representative Bueller, Representative Doherty. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Would you like to go first?
You may go first.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Wilson, esteemed members of the Education Committee. I'm very happy to be here with you. My name is Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. And I see we've emptied out the house. Too bad, because this is an important bill, House Bill 3015, and it is relatively straightforward but important. It allows school district or public charter schools to implement nationally recognized high school assessments in math, science, or English. And the intention is straightforward also. Local school districts increasingly want options other than the smarter balance test for assessment. And that's really the bottom line. I hear frequently from not only teachers, but students and parents and even principals that they're just not happy with the smarter balance test. It takes a lot of time from the classroom. And importantly, in the high school level, the students are having a difficult time being convinced that it's important for them. And you know how it is when you can't convince a teenager that something good for them, and they don't put much attention to it. So Bend LaPine School District specifically has focused on the ACT over the years. They have a long track record. That's their method of assessment. And as you can imagine, the teenagers understand the importance of that test because they're going through the application process. So there's something in it for them also, basically, at the same time. So my school district, and I think many others, would increasingly like to switch over to these other nationally recognized assessments, such as ACT or SAT. So I'd be happy to take any questions, and I'll hand it over to my co-sponsor.
Okay, thank you. For the record, I'm Margaret Doherty. I'm the rep from House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And as a 35-year person involved in education, 10 years as a teacher, actually 11 years as a teacher, and the rest of it as a union representative who was in the buildings literally all day long. I think this is a very important bill, especially when we talk about flexibility. The one thing we've never really given school districts the ability to do is be flexible in what they believe might be the best for their own students. And with No Child Left Behind is when the big push for testing came. Prior to that time, there was not this big, you know, push for testing, but then it was also the idea that, well, the only way we can make sure that kids are learning is to give them a test. And you ask any teacher, any of your child's teachers or anything else, where they are, and they will tell you exactly where every single one of their students are. So I think that's where it's more important of to give the flexibility. And with the ESSA, I think that flexibility is going to be coming, and I know there's discussions about using other sort of resources. And when you've got on the high school level is one thing, and then you've got a different kind of test on the elementary level that they're looking at, but they are very carefully looking at SAT, ACT, which many times are a much better indicator as to either what you learn, what your success will be, maybe what your abilities are, and maybe what you'll be good at once you get out of high school. So those are the sort of things that we're looking at. I think this is a great bill. I appreciate Representative Bueller approaching me on it, because I think with education, flexibility is very important, especially when it comes to assessing our children. So with that, I'm open for questions.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Parrish?
Well, thank you, both of you. I appreciate the conversation. I would love to give school districts lots of flexibility, but we'll save those bills for another day. I do have a specific question, though, about how do you use an ACT or an SAT to then get the results back in a way, because those are more, are you academically sort of prepared to move on to college? But if they're showing deficiency, they're not necessarily structured to show deficiencies, I think, in a way that you can actually then use that from a teacher-student perspective to correct deficiencies. That's not how they're currently being used in our school. I mean, we do Smarter Balance and we do ACTs as well in our districts, but how do you, I don't know that those tests particularly are set up to actually correct deficiencies when a child is not proficient. And the test will show that they missed a question, but it might not track in the way that some of the other types of testing we've currently done, or even previously done, were designed to actually do that more corrective action using the results.
Thank you, Vice Chair Wilson, Representative Parrish. I am first to admit I'm no education or testing expert, but I spent a whole day in Ben Lapine schools hearing from students and from teachers and principals, and they've been using the ACT for that purpose for a number of years and feel very content with it and feel like it's the best that they've encountered and certainly more useful to them than the Smarter Balance test.
And if you look at the difference between the high school and the ACT is a high school instrument, but if you look back at the olden days when they used the OAKS, which is actually a pretty good test on elementary, I mean, that showed where, you know, there might be improvement and so on and so forth. But the bottom line with all of this, even when you have 150 kids or 160 kids on the high school level, you know, I knew who needed help in certain areas. I knew who was very efficient in and was very proficient in a certain area and who wasn't. And so as a teacher, you know where the kids are and where they need the help. And a lot of times, I mean, we give them a test to see, you know, whether they get the concept of Julius Caesar, which is kind of appropriate on March 15th. but not necessarily. I knew that this student, even in high school, had trouble reading. I knew this person had trouble in math. I knew this person had trouble in whatever. And so the educators know where the deficiencies are. A lot of times you don't need to have a test to tell us that, but for accountability for people that are non-educators that are giving quite a bit of money to schools, I think it makes them feel a little better.
And just so. I also heard from the same teachers, they were very enthusiastic about, I think it's the ACT Explorer, the test mm-hmm. that's designed for middle school.
Middle
and they
school.
Use that routinely. They asked me to include that in this. I thought that was just a reach too far for mm-hmm. this particular bill, but they spoke very highly about that middle school test also.
Thank you, Representative Bile, and then Representative McLean.
Chair Wilson, colleagues, I appreciate very much you bringing this, and I'm very enthusiastic about it. My only question is, what's going to happen at the Department of Education if this were to pass? Are we going to see angst and arm waving and concern about now what do we do, or are they willing, as far as you can tell, to let things go back to the local districts and let them work this out?
Well, there's already talk because under No Child Left Behind, there was a little different approach. Now under ESSA, which is coming out of the federal level, it is actually giving the states and the localities the ability to go through and pick out their own tests. And so, you know, it's always angst when you have to change things. But unfortunately, in education, we're used to doing it because we have to do it a lot. And so with this, I think it's the idea of, I know that the Department of Ed has been talking to practitioners and talking to schools and talking to their own people saying, you know, what can we do to give more flexibility? And so, you know, I can't speak for the department, our Department of Ed on the angst, but I know that the ESSA has given them the blessing to go through and make tests more localized and being able to pick out an instrument that they feel is the best for their students.
Follow up. I guess my concern is that we don't use this as an excuse to add FTEs instead of what probably should happen, which is reduce FTEs if they're allowing local jurisdictions to make more of those decisions. And I'm just hopeful that that'll be something we can find a way to weave into the process here.
Yeah, and that question I can't answer.
This should be a relatively straightforward administrative rule. That's the purpose, is so that there's clarity coming from this body of the intention that there should be more local options other than just smarter balance.
And when I read the bill, I get that, but I'm not sure I get it as clear as, okay, DOE, this is what you need to do. So that's my concern.
Well, and I think one thing that ESSA and the Department of Ed is looking at is just not, you know, we're going to take this test over here. It's one that's a proven instrument. And so when you have things like ACT and SAT and, you know, things that have been vetted for a long time, that's the sort of instrument. It's just not, you know, something we're going to, and maybe we will come up with our own test. You don't know, but it's going to be something that will be thoroughly vetted.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr.
The terminology we use is nationally recognized tests.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. We'll go to Representative McLean and then to Representative Parrish after that.
I just wanted to support some of the elements that you just brought out, and that is that in the presentations, which I've heard at least five on SSSA and what Oregon is trying to take back to the Department of Ed, and we don't know what's going to happen at the federal level, but they've already suggested in the Oregon plan that we have these types of tests on the list of possibilities for schools to look at as far as a yearly test. And so I do believe that it's like embedding it into our state foundation. It's like allowing an opportunity for this legislature to bless that idea. It also, this summer I was in a task force on reviewing and sort of auditing the Smart Balance test. And one of the recommendations in that work was that we look at some other nationally recognized tests and or assessments. So I feel like this, you know, really is that this bill is really supporting some of the summer work, and it's really supporting some of the work that Dr. Knorr has been doing on our expression of the SSA federal responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Representative Parrish.
So a little bit of comment and a couple questions. I guess I have a little bit frustrated because, I mean, this is my fourth term in the building. Obviously, there have been people here longer than me. But just even in that short period of time, it's like we start something, then we throw it out the window. And then we start something, and we throw it out the window. Last year, we had legislation to allow people to opt out of testing, to delay testing. So, one, how does this bill line up with the legislation that was just passed in 2015 around letting parents opt out and delays of testing if we were to implement this? Because I think I'd like to see how that's either aligns or doesn't align. You know, the Smarter Balance test got here not with a legislative vote. I just, you know, I think that when they decided to do Common Core, that came out of the Department of Administration. Then we unelected the superintendent. And then we've seen a kind of a revolving door in Ed. And I just feel like our school districts are on a bit of a roller coaster with all of this. And it's frustrating. So I am curious about the piece about how this lines up with other states. Or, I mean, not other states, but the bills we did in 2015. Curious how these line up.
Oh, go ahead. I was going to say, on the opt-out, you've always been able to opt out of a test. That's not something that's new. And so I'm sure that the opt-out will still be there because parents have always had the opportunity, opportunity to do
there
that.
Was specific legislation in 2015 around opt-out.
Well, that was because it was kind of the, you know, I won't say the issue of du jour, but it was at that time. But no, they've always been able to opt out. It was just something that was more memorialized in the bill. And then the other question, I can't remember.
Inconsistency over time?
Well, it's just, I mean, other states are using Smarter Balance quite well. So I'm kind of curious why the Department of Ed made a decision in 2010 to accept and use Common Core. There's a lot of misconception. There was no federal mandate around Common Core. States just individually made that decision. The legislative body never voted for that. We implemented this testing, and then suddenly we're backtracking from it. We haven't really seen if it works or doesn't work, because I don't think we have enough years of data in the mix to say if this test model isn't or isn't, and here we are kind of doing another bill, and I feel like it is like schizophrenic what we're doing to our school districts.
So I'll speak for my school district. They have years of experience and data with ACT, so they see this as more consistent than this Smarter Balance, and I have great concerns about the validity of the testing of Smarter Balance with the high percentage of parents and students that are opting out. So when you have such a low percentage to actually taking the test, and maybe I'm going to show my freedom-loving values here, but I think it's always better to convince people of the value of doing something than forcing someone to do it. And I think with this, you can make the strong case that it's in the student's best interest to take the ACT or SAT, which prepares them for something in the future.
And with the idea of bringing something in and taking it out, bringing it in and taking it out, oh my gosh, that's been going on for 50 years. In education, we've had
and surgery
more
too.
Pardon?
And in surgery.
Oh yes,
and
in surgery.
Things out,
yes.
Put things in.
Yes.
Mm.
You do take things in, put things out. Well, hopefully you put them back right.
Hopefully the right things.
But anyway, I think you know, with this bill, it's the idea of flexibility. It's the idea of giving locals the option. It's the idea of again following state and federal policy. With we're looking at and this very closely follows the idea of national testing, as opposed to having one test dictated to every child. Actually, in the United States. So,
okay. Any further for this panel? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? All right. I see none. We'll take this opportunity to close the public hearing on House Bill 3015. We'll await the chair's return to the dais to tell us what she'd like to do. Let's stand at ease for just a moment. All right. Do we or do we not?
Yeah.
No announcements. All right. With that said, we will adjourn.
Nice job, Chair. Nice job, Chair.
Thank you.
Nice job, Chair. Nice job, Chair.
Thank you.